Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we continue our series of candidate conversations with the Delaware Attorney General's race and our interview with Republican Bernard Pepecott. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have the latest edition of the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A Matter of Facts, where Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism Dean Steve Call discusses journalism in the era of fake news. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We resume our series of candidate conversations, part of Delaware Public Media's 2018 election coverage and the Delaware debates we're producing again this fall with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. We've reached out to all candidates running in statewide races and invited them to sit down with us for an interview. Candidates in each race are asked the same set of questions to allow you to get to know them and compare them. In addition to airing them on The Green, these interviews will be available at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org right through Election Day in November. Today, we return to the Attorney General's race. Last month, we heard from the winner of the Democratic primary, Kathy Jennings. Her September 6th primary victory means she'll face Republican Bernard Pepecott in the general election. Pepecott, a longtime Democrat, is switching parties to run for the GOP, which nominated him after Peggy Marshall Thomas dropped out of the race in mid-August. Pepecott has served as a Delaware Family Court Commissioner, Newcastle County Attorney, and legal counsel for former Democratic Governor Ruth Ann Minner. Here is our candidate conversation with Bernard Pepecott. Why did you decide to run for Attorney General?
Well, Tom, I decided to run for Attorney General because the Attorney General in the Attorney General's office has always affected everything about my life, my entire life, whether indirectly or directly. I am the only candidate that has substantive experience in all aspects of the criminal justice system. I grew up in Northeast Wilmington, and when I was 18 years old, I was arrested and convicted of a felony drug offense. The offense occurred months earlier when I was 17 years old. Mm-hmm. However, my arrest occurred after my 18th birthday, and I was charged and convicted as an adult. At that time, I had given up all hope in life and didn't expect to even live past 25 or 30 years old. It was my attorney that suggested that I should attempt to go back to high school and ultimately apply to college. I received my high school diploma by taking correspondence courses through the mail, and I was surprisingly accepted into college. From the day I stepped foot on the college campus as a student, there was not a doubt in my mind that I was going to be an attorney and I was going to positively affect the criminal justice system. Now, during that time, the challenges, the heartache, the embarrassment that I had to go through being a convicted felon felt like an unbearable weight on my chest. But despite that weight on my chest, I was able to graduate from college magna cum laude and from a superior law school. When I came out of law school and I came back to Delaware, I clerked for the president judge of the Superior Court. I served as a deputy attorney general in the Department of Justice. I served as the deputy legal counsel to the governor. I served as a commissioner in the Family Court of Delaware. I served as the county attorney for Newcastle County government. I served as an attorney for the Delaware General Assembly House of Representatives. And for almost the last 2 years, I opened up my own private practice where I practice criminal defense as a part of my practice. What I have is something that no one else have. I have I have the total package as it relates to the criminal justice system. I have the prosecutorial experience. I have the criminal defense experience. I have the judicial experience. I have the legislative experience. Mm-hmm. I have the policy experience. I have the mentoring experience. I have the experience of actually going through the system myself and experiencing the system personally. I am the living embodiment of what everyone already acknowledges needs to occur within the criminal justice system. And because of that, I am substantially equipped to serve as Attorney General for the state of Delaware, and I want to be an asset to my community.
Let's talk about some specific issues, starting with legislation to rewrite the state's criminal code, revise, consolidate, and streamline it. Stalled in the General Assembly this year, in part because of opposition from the current Attorney General, Matt Dehn. Where do you stand on this effort, which has now been in the works for a number of years?
Well, I believe that the criminal code is deficient in many ways. It definitely needs an overhaul. I think that's pretty clear. There are a lot of the issues that are identified. They do exist. And I think that the criminal code should have an overhaul of some sort. The question is, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. So as far as the total rewrite, I support the effort, but I don't know if that is the proper mechanism because of it may have some unassumed or inadvertent consequences. Mm-hmm. For example, if you do a total rewrite and, you know, I'm not sure what happens to certain case law and mm-hmm. precedent as to whether or not, you know, when issues come up related to charging decisions or what to charge, what not to charge, or certain things, if you don't have certain precedent, you know, you may be starting from scratch or it may leave a degree of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so. Yes, I support the effort. I don't know if that's the proper mechanism. Mm-hmm. I'm open, but, you know, again, I'm not certain that's the proper mechanism.
One issue we've heard a great deal about in this race is mass incarceration and seeking ways to lower the state's prison population. A number of ideas have been suggested. Are there one or two primary ways you feel this issue should be addressed?
Absolutely. My way is I believe that you hear a lot of talk about the back end of the criminal justice system. So you're taking a population that exists and you're saying, okay, let's keep the same population, let's keep the same rate, and let's figure out how to ways to get people out of jail. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the most effective way. What my goal is I want to keep people out of the system in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if you keep people out of the system in the first place, you're not even talking about jail. You can prevent certain crimes and do certain things that reduces that rate on the front end. I would first start with juveniles. And I believe that this can be done with juveniles pretty effectively. And I give you some examples how. When I'm Attorney General, I believe that my status as an Attorney General in and of itself would serve as a certain level of inspiration for certain juveniles either in the system or at risk of being in the system simply because of who I am and what I have gone through and what I accomplished. I can tell them how I can explain to them and relate to them how they may feel or what they may be seeing and how they may be seeing, and can explain to them how they can get from point A to point B to better themselves so they don't have to either stay in the system or they don't have to go in the system. So when I'm Attorney General, I plan to go into every public high school and speak to each public high school so those children in those public high schools that may be going through something can know that it doesn't have to end with what they're seeing right here and now. The other thing that I think that we can do on the front end as it relates to juveniles is that, you know, when I'm Attorney General, you know, one of the things that I plan to do is require all of my deputy attorney generals to mentor at-risk youth. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it builds a relationship. It builds a relationship that doesn't exist. So you have this at-risk youth sees this law enforcement, this prosecutor, and it can become a relationship where this isn't the enemy. Mm-hmm. And it builds relationships throughout communities throughout our state that have been where these relationships either has not existed or they have been severed in recent years. And so this at-risk youth who's building this relationship with this prosecutor, and this prosecutor who's building this relationship with this child, this prosecutor, when he or she making their charging decision, they can say, hey, this sounds like little Johnny. And little Johnny, I know little Johnny's circumstances. So instead of for charging little Johnny with 10 charges, little Johnny, really, this person really should be charged with this one charge because I understand, you know, it went down like this and not like how I would have originally thought. Mm-hmm. And then little Johnny, when little Johnny sees someone in his neighborhood do something bad or he has information, he has a law enforcement a prosecutor that he has a personal relationship with, that he trusts, that he can say, you know, I heard about this crime and I think such and such may have done that. It builds communication and it humanizes both parties. The child humanizes the law enforcement officer, mm-hmm. and the prosecutor humanizes the child, and it's no longer a case. And I believe that can prevent crime. And then the third thing is how we prosecute cases in general. One thing that I would do is I would want to advocate to give more autonomy to schools to handle certain things internally in the schools. For example, 20 years ago, if two middle school kids got into a fight on the school bus, they would be suspended from the school bus and they would come back the next day off of suspension, they're best friends again. Today, those same two middle school kids get in a fight on the school bus, they're arrested, they're kicked out of school, they're charged with assault, they're put in the criminal justice system, and once they're in the system, they have nowhere to go but further in the system. And then once they're in the juvenile justice system, it creates a much greater likelihood that they're going to be in the adult justice system. Those are instances that should be handled by the school, not by the criminal justice system. So there are multiple things that we can do, and we can also do things on the back end to reduce the incarceration rate. For example, people that are convicted of crimes and they serve their debt to society should be allowed to move on with their lives like everyone else. Otherwise, you're forcing them to do things that may not be law-abiding, because at the end of the day, if someone has to eat, they're going to find a way to eat if they're desperate enough, no matter what that entails. Just like if someone is thirsty and there is a dirty cup of water in front of them, they may not drink that water, that dirty water initially, but after you go so long, they're going to drink that dirty water. And we're dealing with the same situation. What better example to demonstrate that people can get on with their lives than if you had the chief law enforcement officer as attorney general in that position who also went through that and was able to get through their lives? So I think that we can do things that stop punishing people after they have already paid their debt to society.
I want to talk about another area that there's been a fair amount of discussion about, and that's racial inequalities in the criminal justice system and ways to address that. Where does addressing that issue start for you? What would your initial focal point be?
Well, I think that the criminal justice system has a lot of components, and the Attorney General's office definitely sets the tone of the entire criminal justice system. So as Attorney General, where it would start with me is internally within the Attorney General's office, although I recognize that there are other components of that system where some other things would need to be done. Mm-hmm. But where it can start in the Attorney General's office is, one, I think that the office has to be reflective of the population it serves. And I think that's the first thing. If you, like I said earlier on, you know, one of the first things I learned in law school is understanding all sides of a particular issue or argument. Mm. And I think the same is applicable as it relates to criminal prosecution and offices that serve the public. It should know all sides of the applicable issue. And currently, and over the last 15 years or even more, and perhaps, you know, the Attorney General's office doesn't have that. And particularly over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, it it hasn't had it at all. It's not reflective of the population it serves. It should be people throughout that office that reflects Delaware population. So you have someone in that office that can understand the circumstances related to the particular cases. You currently don't have that. I think that's where it starts. I think it also starts with certain policies as it relates to charging decisions, because the bottom line is that the attorney general cannot get someone out of jail once they've been sentenced to jail and they're already in jail. The attorney general can advocate, perhaps, but they don't have no authority. Mm-hmm. And it's a false sense of hope to think the attorney general really has that kind of authority. But what the attorney general has authority with is the charging decision. So I think there are certain charging decisions that can be policies related to charging decisions that could be implemented that can help that. For example, in the city of Wilmington, there are all kinds of enhanced charges that a person can have for just because they're in the city of Wilmington. Because, mm-hmm. for example, if you're around a school, church, right. park, that kind of thing, you can get enhanced penalties. So a person's conduct in the city of Wilmington, merely because they're in the city of Wilmington, they can do that same conduct on their front porch. Right. And that same person do that same exact conduct somewhere in Newark, somewhere in Hocassin, or where have you, the charges are substantially different. The bottom line is the city of Wilmington is predominantly minority. And the bottom line is those that are being charged like that are predominantly minority. The attorney general's office has the authority to set policies as it relates to those type of duplicative charges. Mm-hmm. And that's something directly that the attorney general's office can do. And, you know, so those are the things on the front end as well as the back end that, you know, you can do to start with the racial inequality.
I also want to touch on the question of how the state handles possible police misconduct, officer-involved shootings, use of force, other situations like that. The Office of Civil Rights and Public Trust was created in 2015 to help handle these issues and others. Do you feel that office has been effective? And if not, what can be done to improve it?
I'm not sure if I have heard, in my personal experience, heard anyone state that they believe the office has been effective.
Okay.
I haven't seen any fruits of that office one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's something that goes on behind the scenes that I don't know about. I don't know. But what I do know that if I have a tax problem, I go to a tax attorney. And if I have a criminal problem, I will go to a criminal attorney. So it just seems like by nature and the way I think about the process, if you have an Office of Civil Rights and Public Trust, you should at least staff it with a civil rights attorney. And I think that's one thing that you can start with. Instead of for, you know, someone that actually believes in that cause. And I think that within itself can make a difference. That would be one thing. The other thing is obviously resources. Mm-hmm. But even with the same resources, depending on how you situate the people and how you staff certain things, determines the inspiration. Some people who may have a 37.5 hour a week job may work 37.5 hours a week because that's their job. And it's nothing wrong with that. Then you have some people who may have a 37.5 hour a week job who may work 70 hours a week. They're not required to work 70 hours a week, but they do that because they take pride in their work and they like what they do and that's what they're about. So I think that if you have someone in those positions who, if that's what they're about, I think that creates a different tone. So there are so many different nuances, but I don't think anybody who would have a tax problem and is subjected to penalty by the IRS and needs a tax attorney to advise them will go to someone down the street and get someone that only does real estate.
Fair enough. What do you see as the attorney general's role in battling the opioid crisis?
The Attorney General definitely has a role in that. That's very important. The opioid crisis is a big deal. But I, quite frankly, I think that is even broader than the opioid crisis. I don't think it's really an opioid crisis. I think it's an addiction crisis. And you know, even though opioids is the thing that most people refer to, I think those same type of services that we refer to with opioids should be extended to those that may have been addicted to crack or cocaine, mm-hmm. and those individuals should be treated the same way the opioid crisis is treated, like a health issue. Those people should be treated like a health issue so it can be fair and equal across the board. With that being said, one of the things that it is needed is there needs to be more advocacy for treatment beds, more advocacy for resources for treatment. When I was the county attorney, I worked with our police department because we were the first in the state of Delaware and one of the first in the country to start strapping our officers with Narcan. Mm-hmm. So I was a part of that and, you know, and those efforts to deal with that. So I have always, I have been on the cuffs of that. I have actually mm-hmm. worked in that. So that's one of the things that I can do as Attorney General as well, try to work with the various departments and agencies to try to get more resources, more treatment beds in Delaware so we can deal with it. But again, I would submit that I don't see it just as an opioid crisis. I think it's broader than that. I think if the same person that had that issue with the opioids is similar to that person that had that issue with crack.
Mm-hmm. There was talk in the General Assembly about reviving the state's death penalty after the Delaware Supreme Court struck down the previous version of it in 2016. That effort had support of some lawmakers, particularly those with law enforcement backgrounds, and even Governor John Carney suggested he be open to a very narrow death penalty, only for those convicted of killing members of law enforcement. Would you support bringing back the death penalty in any form in Delaware?
I'm a faith-based man. Mm-hmm. I serve as a deacon in my church, and as a general principle, I support life. Mm-hmm. So I do not support the death penalty. However, if the General Assembly enacted the death penalty and it required that the death penalty be imposed in a particular case, I would enforce the law.
All right. And finally, is there another issue you feel is not getting the attention it deserves and you feel strongly about addressing if you're elected Attorney General?
Well, I think the issue is I've been told before that, you know, doing the same thing the same way with the same people over and over again and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. And I think that the one issue that hasn't really been addressed is that's what we have been doing. Mm-hmm. We have been recycling the same people doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So I think that the issue that needs to be addressed is let's do something different. Mm-hmm. Let's do something new. Let's try something from a different perspective, perhaps from one of those aspects that we didn't have the experience or skill set to see it from that direction before. And I think that's how you get something different and change. I think everyone acknowledged that the criminal justice system is defunct and needs to change. So I don't know how you do that doing the same thing with the same people the same way all the time.
Our thanks to Bernard Pepekai, Republican candidate for Attorney General, for his time. Next on The Green, the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast from Delaware Humanities. This is Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created a podcast, A Matter of Facts, to delve into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information. It's part of its mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. Delaware Public Media is proud to help produce this podcast, and we also thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And this week on The Green, we bring you the latest episode of A Matter of Facts. Fake news. The term itself has been around for some time, but you barely heard it a few years ago. Now you hear it all the time. But if you ask people what fake news is, you'd likely get a wide variety of answers. So what defines fake news, and what does it mean for journalism, journalists, and news consumers? To delve into this topic, we welcome Steve Call, Dean of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He is also a staff writer for The New Yorker and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001. And his latest book is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Dean Call, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's start with the definition of fake news. For you, what does that term encompass?
Well, I think these days it primarily refers to two very different things. One is a meaning that the president has popularized by using the phrase so often, and he talks quite openly about his pride in having popularized the phrase, but when he uses it, he's really talking about professional journalism that he objects to, finds slanted or inaccurate. Journalism he doesn't like. But the phrase also meaningfully these days applies to truly fake, invented, made-up stories that circulate on social media. And the origins of that fake news are diverse. There's sometimes headlines that are created for commercial purposes by offshore factories just trying to automatically send sensational headlines across Facebook or other platforms in order to generate advertising revenue. We know that from the indictment of the Mueller investigation that the Russian state was involved in manufacturing fake news. And what's so interesting about the fake news on social media is that it's often deliberately created and designed to look like trusted brands, but with just slight variations. And then the stories are wholly invented. Now, in between, you know, there is sensational news or ideological news that people might argue about the extent to which it's factually grounded. But those are the two big categories that I think of today.
And certainly a lot of this has sown some distrust of those, I guess, what you would consider more legitimate news organizations. And I guess what I'm interested in hearing your opinion on is how do we kind of get to this point where the mistrust of journalism and journalists seems to be much greater, even in those sources that have traditionally been considered bastions of quality journalism and now sometimes are labeled, depending on who you're talking to, as fake news?
Yeah, I think there are several reasons. First, the trust issue reflects broader polarization in our country. So those who identify as Democrats generally do trust establishment brands, most of them. Those who identify as Republicans generally do not, and those who identify as independents are someplace in between. So there's a kind of cause and effect issue around the broader subject of polarization in the country. I think the second important factor, and it's particular to media, and it goes to changes in the industry that have occurred over the last 20 years, is that there has been a profound fragmenting of the media, and the business models have changed as the old newspaper era of the post-war period has yielded to the digital era. And one of the consequences of the rise of digital publishing strategies and social media and 500-channel cable television has been that editorial leaders and business strategists in media have increasingly emphasized emotional engagement with their audiences as opposed to broad, nonpartisan strategies of publishing and broadcasting that prevailed, say, in the 1960s and the 1970s. You know, when I came to the Washington Post in 1985, The newspaper strategy was to be welcome at as many breakfast tables in the Washington area as possible. And the reason was that the newspaper's business depended on advertising, and the advertisers wanted as many households as possible to buy their discounted socks or their automobiles. That era of trying to be all things to all people was also present in broadcasting, because the major news networks operated under license to the Federal Communications Commission, which had then something called the Fairness Doctrine,
right,
that required them to broadcast in the public interest. None of that prevails today. So the New York Times, for example, to take an established name, it no longer gets its revenue from, most of its revenue from advertising. More than half of its revenue comes from subscriptions. And the strategy of subscription is a strategy of emotional engagement with a certain kind of demographic audience. The same thing is true of Fox News. On cable television, Fox News' advertising appeal is very limited because its audience is quite old. But its business is very, very powerful because the viewers it does have are very engaged with Fox, and no cable provider would dare pull Fox News off the air because of the powerful feelings that the Fox-aligned audience has about the network. So these are business and structural changes that have reinforced the broader polarization that we see in the country, and I think they explain some of the problems of trust and the lack of a center in the way we look at our media today.
Is it fair to say that this business model that you're talking about has almost allowed fake news to, you know, hide in plain sight?
Well, I think the fake news, the manufactured lies that pass under news-looking headlines, the rise of that problem, I think, arises a little bit from something else, although it's influenced by this emotional polarization and political polarization. And that is, fake news is really a product of social media, in my judgment. It is the product of the rise of Facebook and YouTube as the primary distribution channels for many, many news organizations. One of the structural changes, besides fragmentation that's occurred in the last 10 years, is that broadcasters and newspaper publishers and magazine publishers have lost control of their own distribution. You really can't reach the audiences you need to reach today unless you use social media and you let Facebook decide who gets to share and see your news stories. Now, there are multiple platforms. They're all sort of quasi-monopolies. Facebook, YouTube, Apple News is a significant one. There's new entrants like Snap that come and go. Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. YouTube, of course, is owned by Google.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at the end of a newsroom's assembly line today, you have people who are employed to basically reformat the news story so that it can be handed off to all these platforms and distributed. Once the news goes onto these platforms, of course, publishers have no way to protect the integrity of the environment that their headlines are coursing through. And what happens is that these offshore and ideological manufacturers of invented headlines pump the same kind of content into these social media platforms. And so you have a mixing of authentic and inauthentic news, and the platforms see themselves as neutral. That's their whole business model. They have resisted the allegation that they're in fact publishers, that they're in fact media companies. And, of course, Facebook famously, until the congressional hearings last autumn, didn't even understand how much Russian-originated content had been coursing across its platforms during the 2016 election. They didn't even report to the public or to Congress the very large scale of that activity until the autumn of 2017, so almost a year after the election. And it's sort of shocking that something like that could have happened without Facebook even knowing about it. So this is a big problem of the influence of social media. I would say one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
American people are not stupid. They know this is going on. And when you look at some of the trust surveys, and, you know, surveying is an imperfect but at least directionally accurate way to measure these kinds of things. And trust itself is a funny word to try to measure scientifically. But anyway, with those caveats, one thing you see is that the number of Americans who say that they trust news they see on social media or Facebook has declined quite significantly in just the last 6 months for all these reasons.
So having said that, you know, how much more of a role should these social media platforms take in policing fake news on their platforms?
Well, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I think a number of us have been very critical of the social media companies for not acknowledging their responsibility and for not even being aware of the malicious activity that they host. But it's kind of a watch what you wish for problem, because if you ask Facebook to start censoring speech or news on the basis of, you know, some idea of quality or trust or fact-based reporting, you're I think inviting a kind of censorship that is not sustainable or desirable. I think the social media companies could do much more affirmatively to promote reporting-based professional journalism of all kinds of origins, not just the New York Times, but also Fox News and also the Weekly Standard and the National Review and other newsrooms that have long established traditions, including of opinion journalism, of actually caring about what the facts are, employing professional journalists who do reporting, and to recognize that part of the reason that journalism is so disrupted in the country is because of the monopoly power of these social media companies that have now acquired something like 80% of the entire digital advertising market in just 10 or 20 years. So they have a responsibility. They are a public square. They should do more to support a healthy public square, but we don't want them to be our censors either. They're not covered by the First Amendment because the First Amendment applies to the government. So in some ways, this is, unless we were prepared to regulate the way we did with the broadcast networks during the heyday of television, mm-hmm. over-the-air television between, say, the end of the Second World War and the birth of cable in the 1980s. You know, in that time, our government, both major political parties, supported regulation of this rare public square that was represented by the broadcast spectrum and the several networks that accessed it. Today, in Europe, you see virtually all of the European Union countries and even the UK moving very strongly to regulate social media for the same reasons we regulated broadcasters in the 1960s. But in this country, there's no appetite yet for that kind of regulation of Facebook and Google. And so I think we're really looking at a kind of self-regulation that is going to be very problematical. I'm not optimistic that these companies are going to address this problem in a significant way over the next few years.
Is part of that lack of appetite, you know, kind of a fear that you'd be opening the door to kind of greater censorship, kind of beyond just the social media piece of it and the social media platforms, that it would be kind of opening a crack in a door that people don't want to open?
I mean, we are a First Amendment country, and so there are constitutional questions about what the government can really do to regulate speech. There's also a political environment that is strongly anti-regulatory, and even when the Democratic Party was in power during the Obama years, and even when it had most of Congress or all of Congress for a couple of years, the Obama administration never really pushed a strong regulatory agenda in Silicon Valley. The Silicon Valley had supported the Obama administration. The companies and the leaders of those companies that would have donated heavily to the Democratic Party, and they were able to avoid regulation and antitrust action as part of their connections to that party's kind of outlook on technological innovation. So the Obama administration was restrained because it said we don't want to stifle innovation. On the right, when the Republicans are in power, they're pushing a First Amendment notion that's very much a part of their kind of libertarian approach to regulation. So you don't really have the politics of regulation at the moment in this country. In Europe, it's different because there's a different tradition about privacy. Mm. And it's really been the defense of privacy that has been driving, as well as antitrust, that's really been driving the European response. But Europeans have been successful at reducing, if not eliminating, external interference at election time on these platforms. In France, there was a lot of anxiety about how the same kinds of patterns that had affected the Brexit vote in Britain and our 2016 election might be repeated in France's election. Germany was also anxious that there could be interference in its recent election, and they used regulation really to prevent it. Now there are there's a new regulation against hate speech in Europe that requires the companies to much more carefully monitor what happens on their platforms than they do in the United States. Now, the European definition of hate speech would never stand here under the First Amendment, but I would end by saying, just because we don't have the politics of any kind of response to this available to us as a country right now, and even though we rightly celebrate our First Amendment traditions, you can look back to very recent eras of our politics where some kind of public interest regulation, some kind of requirement of the companies that they carry out their business activities with the public interest in mind is not a radical departure, and it's consistent. It has been consistent with the First Amendment. So it's not all or nothing. And I think the more these problems persist at places like Facebook and YouTube, the more the public will demand some kind of response to prevent our public square from becoming so deeply polluted the way it is, I think, at the moment.
You mentioned earlier that the public is getting a bit more skeptical of what they're seeing online and on these platforms. What should news consumers do to vet what they see and read and maybe filter out the fake news on their own rather than wait for it to be done for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's hard as a technical matter to identify the most insidious manufactured truly fake news because, as I say, I mean, it's quite subtle. We have a research center here that sometimes shows presentations that just make your jaw drop about, you know, how someone will take something like Fox News and just replicate the logo, but just drop, you know, just slightly different fonts into it in some way so that because they're offshore, they can't get it exactly right. And then under that brand, they'll put in just outrageous headlines and crazy, you know, made-up stories. And I think at first glance, it can be difficult if you're reading news on a shared platform to distinguish between the brand you want to read and something that is imitating that brand. However, there are ways around that, which is basically to make sure that the news you are relying on, you're reading from the publisher's own website rather than from shared kind of platforms. If you want to read Fox News, go to Fox News' site and see what they are publishing there, because that's also happening in parallel with the distribution of news on social media. I think the best way to consume news has always been to have more than one source that you rely on and to try to read the other side's view of a news cycle, too. If you have an ideology that you bring to your reading of the news or political convictions, that's fine, but read more than one source on your side of the line, and then also read a couple sources on the other side and just see what the differences are, because the best way to be literate about the news is to have diverse sources that are authentic. So you have to go directly to their sites. You may have to subscribe if you really want access to quality news. Increasingly, publishers are asking for subscriptions, and that is going to, I think, be a big part of the future of quality journalism, is that people are going to have to decide what they're willing to pay for. The price points of entry now, if you're not buying the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, are not so high. So it is affordable, but you have to decide what you're willing to pay for.
Given all these things that we've discussed so far, should people be worried about the future of the free press in America?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think we're going through, I think the First Amendment is strong. There, you know, despite President Trump's populist strategy of attacking the professional press, which I think is dangerous and bad for the country and bad for the First Amendment, nonetheless, he's not the first populist we've ever had, and he's certainly not the first president to attack the press. I think if you look at the guarantees of a free press that our country has relied on under the First Amendment, that First Amendment tradition is one of the few areas on a polarized Supreme Court where there is strong agreement among the justices appointed by both Republican and Democratic presidents. So I think that the pillars of the First Amendment jurisprudence that we rely on as journalists, such as the Sullivan libel standard, which is one of the most progressive in the world, probably the most progressive in the world, and the prohibition, except in the most extreme circumstances, of enjoining someone from publishing before they do, that was established in the Pentagon Papers. I mean, those kinds of standards I feel are safe. This hostile atmosphere and the polarization can erode press freedoms in other ways. First of all, you see this terrible trolling and even offline threats against journalists. In my experience as an international reporter, when you have an environment where leaders are inciting threats against any group, violence usually follows. And I think there's a lot of concern in the profession now about the atmosphere and where it's going. Secondly, this polarization and kind of heated rhetoric may eventually undermine some of the protections that journalists enjoy under state law. There are 46 out of 50 states that have different kinds of so-called shield laws that offer a qualified privilege to journalists to protect sources in court. And, you know, if the political atmosphere continues in this direction, I would imagine, especially in some states, those protections may be undermined. There's a, you know, we had been making progress as a country on Freedom of Information Act, free records laws, and, you know, you see some of that under challenge, although, you know, it's interesting, one of the best freedom of records laws in the country is in Texas, and, you know, there's a lot of support on the right for transparency about government, and so, you know, we have those issues to work through. If you really step back, you know, the idea of the First Amendment and what journalism was during the 18th century, during the Revolution, and during, you know, almost all of the 19th century looked a lot more like what we've got today. I mean, it was polarized. It was, most newspapers were associated with a political party. They had diverse approaches to evidence and facts. Some played it straight. Others made things up. And it was a chaotic environment and sometimes quite a violent one. And a lot of the readers that are listening to your podcast, we came of age in a different era when there was a vision of journalism as a profession, as something that was responsible to its audience and that would follow a kind of scientific method, that it would be fair, that it would be inclusive of whatever evidence was really relevant to understanding an important public subject, and that it would contribute to an educated citizenry about matters of public policy so that they could make informed decisions at election time. That vision is a 20th century vision. It's now under pressure from the fragmentation that we've discussed. But there are a lot of journalists and a lot of readers who want to think of journalism that way still, because that's what citizens need. They need some kind of reliable sense of the decisions that are being made in their name by their elected representatives, and about the social and economic forces that are challenging their lives, their families. So I still feel, you know, we are, students show up here. The school, Columbia Journalism School, was founded by Joseph Pulitzer more than 100 years ago, on the basis of a vision of professional reporting, nonpartisan scientific reporting about facts. And it was quite a foresightful vision that Pulitzer had. And we always tell the students when they turn up this time of year, you know, this school and its vision of professional journalism, it was founded before radio. We've been through lots of technological disruptions, but the idea of the journalist's role in an open society and what it is we're supposed to do, and how we're supposed to do it, what ethical journalism is, It has endured across all kinds of disruptions and all kinds of political weather, and I think that will be true for the next century as well.
And we'd like to end this podcast by asking each of our guests, where do you get your news, and what are your favorite news sources?
I try to follow my own advice. I mean, I'm a creature of the Washington Post. I spent 20 years there as a reporter and senior editor and foreign correspondent, and I grew up in Washington, D.C., and so I follow the sports teams down there, and I'm interested in local politics. So I subscribe digitally to the Post, and that's on my home screen. I like to read the BBC, and I watch the BBC World News in the evenings because I lived abroad and very interested in international news. And I find the BBC's perspective on international events much richer and fuller. They'll cover a lot more stories than you'd see on the nightly news here. So that's part of my habit. I listen to the broadcast, the five-minute top-of-the-hour NPR broadcast on my phone every morning when just to hear what is in the headlines today. And I don't drive as much as I used to, but I used to listen to NPR, which is, by the way, all things considered and Morning Edition are the largest broadcast audiences in the United States today, larger than the network news. And then I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Financial Times, and the Washington Post, those four papers. So I read those four papers, and then I watch the BBC and listen a little bit to NPR news.
That was Steve Call, Dean of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10th, 2001. Call will be in Wilmington this fall. He'll offer the 2018 Delaware Humanities Joseph P. Del Tufo Annual Lecture, Journalism in the Fake News Era, on October 18th at Studio One at The Grand. You can find more information on that lecture at the Delaware Humanities website, dehumanities.org. The Matter of Facts podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. And we thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. And that's all for this edition of The Green. The interviews and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. For the entire Delaware Public Media staff, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.